Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
A caravan of more than 4,000 Central Americans made their way to the Guatemala-Mexico border and was met by force from the Mexican government.
National Guardsmen are physically guarding the border, but they're also positioned throughout southern Mexico, in part for security, but with that primary mission of immigration enforcement.
I'm Arun Vanigopal, and today on The Takeaway for January 22nd, we check in on the ground and assess the situation. Also on the show, how a series of proposed laws across the country could negatively affect LGBTQ youth.
The reality is we do exist, and making our lives and our medical care a crime is going to do nothing but cause serious harm and, in many cases, life-threatening harm.
We also have a check-in with my WNYC colleague Matt Katz about Japan's asylum system. And actor B.D. Wong explains how his new sitcom connects by telling a very specific story.
There's a sense of reflection that you can't explain if you haven't had it, which is that there's something missing in my life because there's nobody that looks like me on TV at all.
Whole bunch of news to get to. Let's start at the Mexico-Guatemala border. On Monday, security forces began deploying tear gas on migrants along the Mexico-Guatemala border. As more than 4,000 Central American migrants and asylum seekers attempted to cross into Mexico on their northbound journey to the United States, they were met by force from Mexican security forces. The Mexican National Guard deployed tear gas, attempting to prevent the group from entering Mexico. Migrants threw rocks in response. Amidst the chaos, two Honduran children went missing. So far, only one has been reunited with her mother. The caravan of migrants began their journey last week from Honduras, heading north to Mexico and the U.S. border. And as the group traveled through El Salvador and Guatemala, their numbers swelled. In the past year, we've seen Mexico heighten its immigration enforcement efforts, including a rise in the number of deportations and immigration detention. But the Mexican government's response is not just representative of Mexico's migration enforcement. Rather, it also represents the U.S.'s attempt to pressure the Mexican and Central American governments to stem migration flows. Facing threats of economic tariffs from President Trump, Mexico and several Central American countries are now carrying out the task of migration enforcement. Here to help us understand all of this is Maureen Meyer, the Director for Mexico and Migrant Rights for the Washington Office on Latin America. Welcome to The Takeaway, Maureen.
Thank you.
And we're also joined by Jeff Ernst, a freelance journalist based in Honduras. Good to have you with us, Jeff.
Thank you.
Maureen, this is the first caravan of Central American migrants this year. Why do people travel in caravans in the first place?
Yeah, I mean, this is the first caravan in almost a year. Actually, I think we saw, you know, several caravans from 2018 to 2019. Primarily, people travel together, one, for safety in numbers. Mexico has a history of migrants being victims of horrific abuse in the country, kidnappings, robbery, sexual assault. And so traveling together is a way to protect migrants from these risks. It's also, I think, has been in past caravans a way to ensure traveling farther north with the belief that Mexican authorities are less likely to stop massive numbers of people traveling together than small groups.
Is there a governance to a caravan?
You know, every caravan is different. I think we've seen with this caravan and others, announcements made, particularly through social media in Honduras and El Salvador, you know, calling for people to get together and then travel north. They sometimes do seem to have more structure, or migrants themselves organize committees on the way to put order and make decisions on where they're going, what their route is, how long they will be in each place.
What do we know about the actions by Mexican security forces along the border aside from this confrontation? Were any migrants detained and deported?
Yeah, I mean, I think this caravan is the first caravan after, you know, the pressure from the Trump administration on Mexico to crack down on immigration enforcement and the agreement signed last June where Mexico really committed to increasing enforcement and deploying the National Guard to the southern border. Beyond, you know, what happened in that incident, we've seen it's very difficult to cross the river to get into Mexico. It's very difficult to get through major highways in southern Mexico. It's become sort of a virtual wall for migrants. And there's a lot of concern, not just about these incidents of use of force, but conditions in detention centers where migrants are being held, often with, you know, poor sanitation, not enough food, not enough water, to lack of real clarity by Mexican officials of what will happen with the people that have gone with Mexican officials, whether they'll be detained and deported, whether they will be able to request asylum in Mexico.
Jeff, you're in San Pedro Sula, Honduras. Can you tell us more about the origins of some of these caravans?
They start out just with a simple call on Facebook, usually. This time, those calls usually came with invitations to join these WhatsApp groups that swelled to usually hundreds of people each. And that's pretty much how people organized this time around.
Tell us about the conditions in Honduras and why people are fleeing en masse.
You know, there's really two major things. There's the economic push factors that, you know, there just is an opportunity here. A person can do everything right, and they still won't be able to get a job. Even if you get a job, 80% of employment pays less than the minimum wage, and the minimum wage isn't sufficient to purchase the basic basket of goods for a family of four. So economically, most people, they just have nothing to lose. Then we have the security situation, where the homicide rate has nearly halved since it peaked in 2012. But this year, preliminary data shows that it has started to rise again, just slightly. But particularly in cities like San Pedro Sula, the total homicide count went up by roughly 20%. And in neighboring Chiloma, the third largest city in the country, it went up 30%. And that would put both cities in the top 20 most violent cities in the world. And it's not just homicide, it's extortion. Extortion is rampant. So people who have small businesses or try to be entrepreneurs, you know, eventually the gangs arrive at the door to charge a tax, and oftentimes puts them out of business. And then overarching the economic and security factors is the political situation, where we have a president who was reelected under dubious conditions, under massive allegations of fraud, who has been named a co-conspirator in a drug trafficking conspiracy, and whose brother was recently convicted in a New York court case for drug trafficking. And so the political situation suffocates any hope for change in the near term.
Maureen, last Friday, the Mexican government promised this group of migrants jobs. How did that play out?
I think that is one of the main concerns of this caravan and the way the Mexican government responded, because for the most part, it looks like they promised them jobs, but primarily back in Central America. There is growing cooperation between the Mexican and Central American governments to address some of the push factors, particularly the economic factors that Jeff referred to. And what we have seen in terms of papers provided through social media to journalists and others was offering people to go back to their home countries, be subsidized by the Mexican government, but basically work back home. There are limited job opportunities in Mexico's southern states. So what the government has offered is temporary work visas to work only in southern Mexico. So I think making clear again that there is not any visa or any way for these individuals to get to the United States, to the U.S.-Mexico border. But if they want to work in southern Mexico or back in their home countries, the Mexican government is offering to support them in this.
So are these offers seen as some sort of middle ground, or are they seen as being made in bad faith?
You know, I think everybody's going to make their own decision. We have heard interviews with migrants that say if they're offered a job and the ability to stay in southern Mexico, they might take the Mexican government up on that option. I think the more concerning part is, what would it look like for someone to go back home, particularly if the reason they left was not just the economic situation, but because they were fleeing, you know, persecution by gangs or other types of violence and really didn't feel safe in their home communities, in which case, you know, going back even to work is probably not an option. And I think that's also important to highlight, that more and more people are requesting asylum in Mexico. I'd say Honduras is actually the top country for asylum seekers. Mexico had 70,000 asylum requests last year. It's more than double the amount they received the year before. So certainly more and more people looking at Mexico as an option to stay and to be safe.
Tell us about the Mexican National Guard, Maureen, and if you could remind us how it was formed and why it was put in charge of immigration enforcement.
The National Guard was a new security force created during President López Obrador's first few months in office. It was meant to be their federal security force, replacing the federal police. It is primarily a military force. It's led by a military general. About 80% of its members, about 80,000 people, are members of the Mexican Army or Navy. And I think, you know, one of its first missions, actually its first mission, was to be deployed to Mexico's southern and northern border for immigration enforcement. And so what we see now are images like in the weekend where National Guardsmen are physically guarding the border, but they're also positioned throughout southern Mexico, in part for security, but with that primary mission of immigration enforcement, something which they are not trained to do, and which raises a lot of concerns of how a primarily military force is interacting with vulnerable populations.
And how much is this at the behest of the U.S.?
I think it's clear this was a response of the pressure from the Trump administration on Mexico. The agreement in June that both governments reached, the key element of it was, we are going to deploy our National Guardsmen to Mexico's southern border and ensure as many people as possible are detained and likely deported back to their home countries, with the aim of really dropping the number of migrants that are able to reach the U.S. border and, you know, request asylum in the United States or some other type of status.
So from the perspective of American nationalists, people who are trying to prevent immigrants from entering the country, has this been a policy success?
I think the Trump administration has been effective at bullying and threatening Mexico into taking on a higher role in immigration enforcement and certainly reducing dramatically the number of people that are able to reach the U.S. border. The other part of that agreement was also what is known as the Remain in Mexico program, which enabled the U.S. to return back to Mexican northern border towns, U.S.-bound asylum seekers. So you have over 50,000 people that are also waiting on the Mexican side of the border, which has also dropped the number of people that are actually reaching and entering the United States.
Jeff, what about the U.S. and Honduras? What does that relationship look like now?
The Honduran government is particularly dependent upon U.S. approval, especially now with all these allegations of drug trafficking and corruption surrounding the Honduran president. So Honduras has signed a safe third country agreement where it will start receiving migrants who've been deported from the U.S.-Mexico border and supposedly offering them asylum in Honduras or giving them supposedly safe place to stay while they wait for their asylum claim in the U.S.
Maureen, Mexico's new president, López Obrador, has only been in office for a year. What has all of this meant for his stature in Mexico?
You know, López Obrador continues to enjoy really high levels of support. He is still very popular in Mexico, and I think his government has framed this in two ways. One, we are being successful and maintaining a good relationship with the Trump administration, which López Obrador has put as a priority. And second, that they are not distancing themselves from the administration's original approach, which was we want to treat migrants humanely and offer them opportunities in Mexico. So I think the Mexican population usually doesn't view this as a top issue. They're more concerned about the economy and security in Mexico and are willing to take López Obrador at his word that this is important for his government and for their relationship with the United States.
Maureen Meyer is the Director for Mexico and Migrant Rights for the Washington Office on Latin America, and Jeff Ernst, a freelance journalist based in Honduras. Maureen, Jeff, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
All over the world today, almost 70 million people have been forcibly displaced from their homes, and every year, thousands of these people try to seek refuge in Japan.
I've never been a refugee before now, so I really don't know how it works.
Rose, a refugee from Cameroon, is one of these women.
But I just hope it works well for me.
For Rose, trying to make a home in Japan meant leaving her whole life behind just so she could be safe. But of the 10,000 people who apply for refugee status in Japan every year, only 40 get approved.
For like a week, I did not sleep. I was like, what have I gotten myself into? Maybe it was better to be there and wait for death when it comes, or whatever. I did not know what to think.
Rose's story is one of many where asylum seekers flee prosecution, only to end up in a country where they're not welcome. Just a note that we're not using Rose's real name here to protect her identity. Matt Katz is a reporter at WNYC and went to Japan to report on this story. Thank you for joining us, Matt.
Thank you, Arun.
Before we begin, Matt, let me just mention to our listeners that I did listen to some of the early drafts of your reporting as part of a listening session here at WNYC and made some suggestions on other parts of this series. To me, Matt, Japan is a really fascinating example of a country that has severely restricted immigration. And based on how some people responded to your series, it has a lot of symbolic value, not just to people in Japan, but to people here in the West, correct?
Yeah, I realize that there is a fascination, even a fetish for the perception that Japan is monoethnic. So white supremacists really love this idea of Japan as this society that has successfully been able to restrict immigration to stay, quote unquote, Japanese and still be part of the, you know, global community. So when I reported on the fact that there's such restrictions to immigration, and the white supremacists responded and said, leave Japan alone. Don't bring these globalist ideas into what is an otherwise perfect society.
So let's talk about one of the people who was displaced and sought refuge here in Japan, Rose.
She's an interesting case because very few people are aware of the conflict in Cameroon. It's one of these many flashpoints throughout the world that are creating refugees. Cameroon is going through what's basically a civil war right now between French speakers and English speakers. It is literally a conflict over language. The government is controlled by the Francophones, and Rose comes from the Anglophone region. And the English speakers have long said that the French-speaking government have not given them fair rights. So Rose's family was involved in a separatist movement in Cameroon to break away from this French-speaking controlled government. And she lost touch with that movement because she actually was sexually assaulted by soldiers who were looking for her father when she was a teenager. So she didn't want anything to do with politics. She moved away from her home village and she became a teacher. She came back home on a visit in 2016 and she joined a teacher protest. She says she just thought it was a protest to push for more resources for English-speaking schools. But teachers and lawyers have been at the tip of the spear of this separatist movement in Cameroon, and they're seen as anti the Cameroonian government. So this protest, the government came down quite hard on it. She starts to explain a little bit about that in an interview I did with her.
The military will come with their van and they're like, you get in, you get in, you get in, and let me have your phone, you give your phone. So there were times they would take us all and not everybody would come back. Like, I have two colleagues till today, we've not heard from them. It's more than a year. And in Cameroon, you could be awaiting trial for 3 or 4 years, and nobody's talking about you. Nobody's getting back to you. So that was when I noticed that maybe one day will be my turn not to come back.
And she needed to leave. That's what she decided. So she used all of her money. She borrowed a bunch of money and she hired a broker. This is what people throughout the world do when they need to leave their country. They hire somebody in the black market to figure out a way out of where they're at. And the broker came back to her with an unusual offer.
So he just called me and asked me that, what if I told you I got a visa for you for Japan? I said, I'll be happy. He said, yeah, I got a visa. That was on a Wednesday morning. And he told me I had to leave on Thursday morning.
So she has literally hours to pick up and move to another continent.
Right. And she really embodies the story of refugees today. They leave in a hurry and there are conflicts all throughout the globe. People are just flying into Tokyo and declaring asylum. They're asking to stay, and they're doing it by the thousands. So Japan cannot stay this isolated island that it had been for centuries. She finds a guy at the airport who speaks English, and he takes her around to a bunch of hotels until she finds one that she could afford. She had $100 in her pocket. And then she calls this woman who's an acquaintance of an acquaintance who's from Cameroon, and she goes to her place in Japan, and She spends a couple of nights there. This woman tells her about a nonprofit called Japan Association for Refugees. She goes to this office. She says where she's from and what she needs, and she'd like to figure out how to declare asylum and get a job and stay in Japan. And they tell her there's no way she's going to win asylum in Japan.
I'm like, how is this possible? Why won't they believe that people are truly in danger? Why won't they believe that people are running for their lives?
But the people from the Japan Association for Refugees say, I'm sorry, but Japan doesn't take hardly any refugees. They took just 42 people last year. And many of them, when they declare asylum at the airport, just like what happens in the U.S., if you land at JFK or LAX and you declare asylum, you often get detained and you're held in detention until your hearings. And what's interesting is people who follow the asylum process in America will hear parallels. It's a similar sort of thing that's going on in this country now. It is increasingly difficult to find safety in the U.S. if you're claiming that you face persecution at home. And that same phenomena is happening all over the world, in Japan, in the U.S., and in Europe. All of these countries signed agreements after World War II with the U.N. saying that anybody who is facing persecution can find safety in these countries. But in reality, that's just not the way it's working anymore.
And so Rose is in this predicament. She enters into this landscape, and she's trying to navigate it. What happens to her?
So she was able to get subsidized housing through this nonprofit, and she takes Japanese lessons, and she submits her application for asylum. She lives a very meager lifestyle there. She has rice and nothing else most days of the week. And she tries to adjust to life in Japan, because the thing about asylum seekers is it takes months and even years in the U.S. or in Japan or elsewhere for your case to be reviewed, even if you know that you're going to end up getting deported at the end of it.
And so basically, this might be seen by some people who are critics of the Japanese system as a way simply of keeping out diversity. When you interact with people from Japan, how do they see people like Rose?
There's very little in the way of overt discrimination. You don't hear people saying disparaging things about immigrants. There's also very little civic conversation about immigration compared to what we hear in this country in terms of it dominating television and news and public conversation. It's quieter restrictive approach. There's a understanding that Japan needs to attract foreigners, but there is concern that too many foreigners can echo the scenes people have seen on TV of Syrians entering Europe, of people in the Mediterranean Sea in boats, amassed on boats trying to get into Greece, or the caravans coming from the southern border of the U.S. And Japanese are aware of those images, and there are concern that Japan could be overrun with these immigrants and asylum seekers. And then the most pragmatic of the Japanese tell me that they need the foreigners and that their country can't survive without bringing in these immigrants. But in the meantime, the stance of the Japanese government is more of a outsourcing approach. So Japan is a quite generous donor to the UN Refugee Agency, but that money is really to house and feed refugees in camps abroad rather than spending money to resettle them in Japan.
So what does life in Japan hold for Rose?
She's looking for work. She's allowed to work while she's applying for asylum. And then she's looking for community. She has made a friend, a Japanese friend, who takes her around and introduces her to new food. But she spoke movingly to me about how loneliness is one of the many obstacles that refugees face. It's not just money. It's not just trying to learn the language and navigating the streets. It's this almost unbearing sense of loneliness. It's something that I think immigrants and asylum seekers and refugees the world over experience. And she tries to deal with that by, you know, talking to her son every day and calling family back home. But she doesn't know what will come of her situation. If she's there for 2 years and then is deported, if she's allowed to stay in Japan, will she be able to get a job? And will she be able to have the money to one day reunite with her son? As in many of my conversations with the refugees there and in the U.S., it comes down to family separation. Being apart from family and the way the conflict all over the world and restrictive borders all over the world have led to this family separation, almost an epidemic of family separation, is the prevailing emotional difficulty that these immigrants experience.
Matt Katz is a reporter at WNYC. Thanks for joining us, Matt.
Thank you, Arun.
Across the country, a series of newly proposed state laws have the potential to limit the rights of young LGBTQ people. A dozen states are proposing bills that would ban transgender youth from participating in school sports and ban doctors from providing gender-related hormones and surgeries to minors, even if they have parental consent. If passed, these bans could have lasting psychological and medical implications for transgender minors living in those states. Joining me now is Chase Strangio, a transgender rights lawyer with the American Civil Liberties Union. Chase, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Who is leading this legislative push, and how would you characterize their motivations?
Yeah, I think for the past, 5 years, I would say we've seen a real systematic effort across the country to target transgender people in state legislatures. And it's a combination of local family policy institutes and then national groups like the Alliance Defending Freedom and Family Research Council that are sort of have an ideological mission to push, in my view at least, LGBTQ people out of public life. And not only that, encourage societal norms and policy practices that would force us to live, inauthentic ways. And so that has really been the impetus for these bills, and we've seen an uptick over the past several years.
So what's the kind of language they're using to rally support around this cause?
Yeah, when it comes to transgender youth who have been the primary target of so much anti-LGBTQ legislative action in the past 5 years, the supporters of these measures really talk about trans people and trans young people especially as somehow a threat to others, as if, allowing someone to go about their lives consistent with who they are, finally living their truth, is going to somehow harm the rights of others.
Let's start with the bills banning hormones and surgeries for minors. What states have these bills on the docket, and what types of hormones and surgeries would be banned?
So these bills actually are broader than that, and they would not only ban gender-affirming care for minors, which would include at times even mental health care, any affirmation of a young person's gender identity, but also hormone blockers and hormone therapy and surgery to the extent surgery is even available to minors. So we're seeing those bills in South Carolina, in Missouri, in South Dakota. And in some of those cases, in South Dakota, for example, the bill would actually make it a felony for a doctor to treat a transgender young person who is both consenting to, having their parents' support for, and having a medical need for treatment. So what we're seeing is every single person in this young person's life is saying this is absolutely 100% medically necessary, supported by the American Academy of Pediatrics, supported by every major medical association, and lawmakers suggesting that a doctor should go to prison for 10 years for keeping up that care for the young person.
Would any of these bills prevent trans minors who are already taking hormones from continuing to take them?
Yeah, and that's one of the most alarming things. If you can imagine, you're on this medical treatment that is saving your life. And so, take a young person in South Dakota who's 17 years old, let's say, who has been on hormones for 3 years. If this bill passes, all of a sudden, that treatment is going to be cut off immediately, which is going to have such severe physical and mental health consequences that could lead to suicidality and possibly death. So we're really talking about lawmakers playing, with fire here. And the fire is the the lives of young trans people in their state.
Republican South Dakota State Representative Fred Deutsch, who authored a bill in his state banning puberty blockers and surgery on minors, recently told the Christian Post that, quote, "We know from the literature that approximately 85% of children that are confused about whether or not they are a boy or a girl, that the confusion goes away naturally." Is there any substance to what he's saying?
Well, what he's doing is he's distorting information about young LGBTQ and gender nonconforming children in the service of a narrative about trans youth. So the statistics that he's referring to are about young kids who are gender nonconforming who often don't turn out to be trans later in life. Those children are not the ones who are diagnosed with gender dysphoria and receiving treatment. They're just, you know, young people who show, you know, gender atypical behaviors, which a lot of people do. And, you know, and some of those people, you know, end up having consistent and persistent cross-gender identification. For those young people, they may receive a diagnosis of gender dysphoria and receive treatment consistent with very well-established medical protocols. So Representative Deutsch, who I will add, has led the fight over the past several years, introducing bill after bill targeting trans young people, some having nothing to do with medical care, is essentially taking a statistic wholly unrelated to trans people to try to suggest that trans young people who have a very well-documented medical need for care should have that care cut off and criminalized.
One lawmaker in Utah, Brad Daw, told NBC News that his bill would allow puberty blockers, but that it prevents surgeries and hormone therapy. And he's quoted as saying, "We want to do what we think is reasonable practice, which is put off that kind of one-way ticket decision until the youth is an adult." Is there an argument to be made along the lines of what Daw is saying?
With respect to surgery, very few minors are receiving surgical treatment. And if they are, it's chest surgery for older adolescents, and only when it's being supported by the established medical protocols and the young person. Now, when it comes to this idea that we can't provide hormones or surgery because it's permanent, it's important to remember that there is nothing more permanent than childhood trauma leading to suicidality. We have an epidemic with young trans kids, you know, over 50% having suicidal ideation and over 41% of trans people having attempted suicide in their lifetime related to not being affirmed in their gender. So having hormone therapy, which, you know, does not have permanent traumatic impact, you know, denying that therapy could lead to permanent traumatic impact or even death. So we need to think about and question what we mean by what's permanent and how it's so important based on the data and the literature to actually affirm young people in their gender, including through medical interventions.
Chase Strangio is a transgender rights lawyer with the ACLU. Chase, thank you for joining me.
Thanks so much for having me.
We were just talking about a slew of recent bills that target trans youth. But while some conservative states are moving to curtail rights, others are expanding protections for members of the LGBTQ community. Last night, Utah became the latest state to provide protections against conversion therapy when the state's governor put a rule banning the practice into effect. Joining me now is Troy Williams, executive director of Equality Utah, an organization that worked closely with the Mormon Church and the state legislature on this initiative. Troy, welcome to The Takeaway.
Hey, it's great to be here, Arun.
So this rule banning conversion therapy is now in place. Walk us through exactly what's in the rule and how it's intended to work.
Yeah, well, the rule has the efficacy of law, and it provides that state-licensed mental health therapists who subject a minor to conversion therapy will have engaged in unprofessional conduct and then can be subjected to disciplinary proceedings by one of the state's mental health licensing boards.
What effect does this therapy have on young people?
Well, the data is pretty clear. When young people are subjected to conversion therapy, their rates of depression double and their attempts at suicide triple. And for us here in Utah, this is a critical issue. Suicide rates for young people have spiked 141% over the past decade. It's the leading cause of death for young people in Utah.
And I imagine that that may be even worse for LGBTQ kids, correct?
Absolutely. Absolutely, yes.
Now, Utah is a conservative state. How did this initiative get the support of Republicans like Governor Gary Herbert and the Mormon Church.
Yeah, you know, I think suicide is not a partisan issue, right? And so when we looked at the data and we brought the data and we brought the stories of conversion therapy survivors to the governor, to the leaders of the LDS Church, and when they shared their stories, hearts were moved, minds were opened. And when we know better, we do better. And when we heard the stories, the governor acted swiftly.
Was there pushback?
Oh, yeah. You know, you don't advance a measure like that without, you know, people challenging us. But that provided us an opportunity to share our stories. And when we brought we had a few public hearings on these issues. And oh, boy, conversion therapists crawled out of the 1980s and 90s to testify against our proposed rule.
Now, who are these groups who are opposed to ending conversion therapy?
Well, it's a familiar cast of characters. It's the Utah Eagle Forum. It's Family Watch International. Mm-hmm. It's folks who, as your previous guest alluded to, are focused on excluding LGBT people from public life.
Now, Troy, in states where conversion therapy is still allowed, if activists and lawmakers are looking at Utah for ways to pass rules like this, what advice do you have?
Well, Governor Herbert was really wise. He said that science should prevail over politics. He saw that this was a polarizing issue, and so he sent it to the Board of Psychologists who drafted the rules and regulations. So we applaud that. We want to keep young people healthy and alive. We want to make sure that they have an opportunity to thrive in every sphere and every facet of our society, because that's what's going to keep them healthy and happy.
My guest has been Troy Williams, Executive Director of Equality Utah. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
It's The Takeaway. I'm Arun Vanigopal in for Tanzina Vega. For the past 2 years, Awkwafina has had an impressive run in Hollywood, from starring in Crazy Rich Asians and The Farewell to hosting Saturday Night Live. It would be understandable if she wanted to take a quick break from it all, but clearly that's not her style. This week, Awkwafina is adding yet another credit to her name, starring in a sitcom loosely based on her own life called Awkwafina is Nora from Queens. Here she is alongside B.D. Wong, who plays her dad, Wally.
Sometimes you make a big move because you think you're supposed to, and sometimes you make a big move because you're really ready to make a big move. But, you know, I'm always here.
Thanks, Dad. Because if you did have that $500 to get my car out, that's all right.
On the show, Awkwafina's character is a relatable slacker living with her father and grandmother late into her 20s and struggling to keep a job. And while the circumstances are no longer true to her life, the vibrant Queens community depicted on the show still feels very real. That sense of community is something that resonated with B.D. Wong and his memories of growing up in San Francisco.
Looking back on my childhood, there was a real sense of Asian Americanness and Chinese Americanness around me that I think was very valuable. And at the time, I thought I was being forced to go to Chinatown once a week for my family to kind of give me a reminder of what it meant to be Chinese American. And now I'm really grateful for that. That was a really useful thing to happen to me because we had moved out to the avenues where there were not as many Chinese families.
Teresa Hsiao, one of the executive producers of Awkwafina's Comedy Central show, had a slightly different experience growing up in a small town in Massachusetts.
We were pretty much the only Asian family in the town growing up. So anytime we ever saw other Asian people, we would do the kind of like, hey, you're Asian too, head nod to them.
I sat down with B.D. Wong and Teresa Hsiao to talk about bringing Awkwafina's story to the screen. And I started off by asking them if they thought their family stories were worthy of being told on television when they were growing up.
I grew up much longer ago than Teresa did in a way where I think there was no concept of that. There was no sense of even what inclusion and diversity even were. They weren't words we used. And so therefore I considered myself culturally the opposite of what people wanted to see or wanted people to produce or generate content-wise.
What about you, Teresa?
And I think at least we grew up watching so many other people on screen.
Yes,
so we grew up watching every other, family on screen, but you never ever saw your family. So it wasn't even something that crossed my mind. Like getting into entertainment, it wasn't, oh, I want to you know, showcase my community on screen. It was more just, oh, I love television and I want to be part of it. But it didn't even, you know, when Fresh Off the Boat came out, and obviously All American Girl back in the day, but when Fresh Off the Boat came out, it was sort of the first time where I went, oh, wow, people are interested in this and people are watching, people want to watch a family like mine. And it was mind blowing. I really hadn't ever thought about it before.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting that we think people say things like I saw myself or I didn't see myself, and I don't think people really understand what that really means. You know, it's not just like an employment opportunity. Oh, there are Asian people and I'm Asian, and so we're there, there's a kind of silent solidarity. There's a sense of reflection that you can't explain if you haven't had it. Which is that there's something missing in my life because there's nobody that looks like me on TV at all. Because the TV is such a influential kind of media tool, and it's being exploited and used by all these other people, and you're not a part of that conversation at all. So there's an actual feeling of exclusion that I don't think people really fully understand. They think, oh, you just want to see yourself or whatever, how cute or whatever. There's a real strong attachment you have that one feels. And I think that's super important because I think people devalue that whole equation. And it's becoming more and more clear how valuable it is.
I mean, that's the thing is, like, when we talk about representation and how important it is to the people who have not so far historically been represented, now that we're seeing this whole wave of exciting shows like yours and, you know, Fresh Off the Boat and what, come on, we realize that, you know, it is important for those people who get to finally see themselves. But we also realize, like, gosh, why were, say, white, you know, creatives not curious? Why were they not driving that? What about the lives of others, if you will, you know? And you realize, like, the barriers to getting people to see outside of their very narrow world views or whatever. And, like, I mean, I guess, Teresa, you must be dealing with this as a writer and as a producer, having encountered that in different writing rooms, I'm guessing.
Yeah, at pretty much the start of my career, every show I worked on, I was writing for people who looked different from me, or writing for cartoon characters who looked different from me, but families that weren't necessarily reflective of my own life. But I think it's one of those things where when we grew up, we just watched all these other people, and we were able to relate to all these other people, and we had crushes on all these other people, and, you know, we looked up to them and we saw ourselves in Rachel from Friends or whatever it was.
Yeah.
And so we were able to connect with a different culture and be able to kind of ingratiate ourselves to that culture, whereas a lot of perhaps white people who always saw their own kinds of families on screen, they never got to see other cultures.
They never got to exercise that muscle.
Exactly.
That muscle that is a very usable muscle and very useful in your life to think outside of yourself.
To be able to see yourself in a different kind of world that you didn't grow up in. And I think, you know, I do think it did make me a better writer because you're able to sort of empathize with other cultures and understand them a little better. And now, obviously, now that there's actual interest in showing these other communities, you know, it's really valuable and important, I think. And it's exciting because now there are other writers out there who are coming from communities that have been traditionally underrepresented, and they can tell these stories.
And I think the non-specificness, you know, it's an Asian American family in this, it's specifically a Chinese American family in Queens in our show. And yet it's not a typically Asian American family, or one that is drawing on references that anybody has of past Asian American families that they have seen. It's its own family, which is ultimately an American family of a certain kind of configuration, a young woman still living at home with her father and her grandmother. And that's a configuration that anybody can recognize. It completely has nothing to do with them being Asian American, actually. And that's one of the great values of this show, is that it's not serving up something that's particularly expected. And so that allows people, I think, to relax and find universality in it, because it's even less alienating because it's less different. It's not, oh, well, they're Asian, I could never be like that. It's like, oh, I see that kind of weird dynamic where this young woman is kind of at odds with living at home. That's a very entirely universal thing.
BD, you've spoken before about how a lot of the roles you were offered early on in your career were
doctor roles.
Yeah.
Did that start changing at some point for you? Or has it changed?
Well, this is indicative of the fact that it's changed. And some of the work that I've done in the last few years since I left Law & Order have really proven to be me being allowed to be more of myself, which I was considered myself more of a character actor. And while I was on that procedural for 11 years, I kind of lost that identity and had to kind of get it back as far as, not just as far as how I felt about myself, but how I felt other people perceived me, the industry perceived me. And so once I got back into character actor land, I felt more like I was myself as an artist. And this show is a part of that trend. And I do feel less of a pigeonholing feeling that I did before. You know, there was a point where my managers and myself and my agents sat down and said, you know what, no more doctors. We actually have to say, if it's a doctor, we probably shouldn't do it. Because I had worn so many lab coats and so many shows. That was a joke that I would go to the fitting and see a lab coat on the rack and go, oh, you know, and kind of like throw my hands up, here we go with another lab coat, and try to kind of get them to tailor the lab coat so it looked flattering or
sexy,
or
try lab to coats.
Yes, sexy lab coats. So yeah, and so that, I can't say that that's completely past, but I think I have allowed, at least for myself, to forge another kind of tributary in this kind of river of content that allows me to feel like I'm more myself as a creative person.
Now, The Takeaway spoke with Margaret Cho last month, and one of the things she talked about was the, you know, fairly widely publicized negative experience she had on her ABC sitcom, All American Girl, which came out in the early 90s.
Yeah.
Had a brief run. You played her brother.
Yeah.
What was doing that show like for you?
I was very close to Margaret, especially at that time, and it was really painful. It was very heart-sinking, kind of. We all had such high expectations and high hopes for her as a young star, very similar to the feelings that we have about Awkwafina now. And this was at a time when they groomed comics for their own sitcoms, and she didn't get a fair shake from, really, in my estimation, as a person with a unique perspective and a point of view and a vibe. She didn't get the show that expressed who she was, which is why I'm so impressed and so excited for Awkwafina to be able to have that opportunity to be herself, to have the show reflect who she actually is, her sensibility as a comic, her sensibility as an actor, her sensibility, period, as an Asian person, and for there to be a kind of follow through on all departments that allow her to put the show forth in a way that is authentic to her. Margaret was not so lucky, and it was a much earlier time in the development of the diversity discussion, in a way that she was kind of shoehorned into this disinfected kind of equation, and it was actually counterproductive to who she actually was. She was an equally kind of potty mouthed, kind of edgy, really. And there wasn't as much cable content, or there was no cable content at that time. So imagine Margaret now as a, you know, it's a very similar kind of thing. And it's a really great comparison to make culturally between what they both went through. So it was very sad. And it was kind of like watching something that you have such high hopes for kind of slipping away, a kind of feeling of slipping away. And there was great joy in it too. We were very proud of it. We were very happy to be working on it. There was lots of wonderful good times. I made some of the best friends that I made during that run of that show. And so it was interesting. And I felt for her tremendously because she was, I would say, go so far as to say, a victim of a system that was not going to work for her.
I think maybe the difference too now is that obviously Awkwafina has so much more creative control, and we were able to tell the story from, you know, Asian American creators. We didn't, you know, the network afforded us a lot of leeway in terms of hiring, and they trusted us to hire people who we thought were right for the show, and not necessarily just, hey, here are a bunch of seasoned comedy veterans who haven't ever written for this kind of family before. So that was really important. And just, you know, this show really does represent her, and she was really able to put her stamp on it in a way I don't think that Margaret was able to with All American Girl.
Through no fault at all of Margaret's.
No, I mean, Margaret, not at all. Yeah, she should have been.
She should have been. And it's kind of kind of a mind-blowing that the mechanism at that time was not in place to understand the power of saying, okay, who are you? And let's make you, you know, let's make sure that it's you, the core of truth of who you are is the core of the show, because
exactly.
The success that makes you a successful performer should be the same course essence. And so, you know, that seems like a no-brainer to us now when we look back. But instead, there was a very corporate kind of homogenization and a kind of like, oh, let's put it through this kind of mechanism that was tried and true for Ellen and for Roseanne. But it certainly did not speak to anything with a strong sense of individuality or
humanity.
Or humanity, really, or truth to her, who she is. Her story is equally interesting. The story they made up for her was really not particularly interesting at all. I think they thought at the time it was culturally interesting because it was juxtaposing the East and the West and
yeah,
all of that stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
And it
in
was
a very,
very
didactic sort of like binary kind of a
very,
formula.
Yeah.
Yeah, 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 yeah. That's right. She's the girl who's pushing back against yeah. the strictures and the confines yeah. of her traditional Eastern
yeah.
upbringing.
And I was kind of the model minority, kind of older sibling who created pressure for her in a way. So that's all,
right.
You know, even now when I say that out loud, it just seems so kind of tired and uninspired, really. But we made the most of it, and we did what we did, and we were proud of what we did. And I'm very proud of Margaret for having kind of done what she did with it. And then subsequently, she took that experience and made beautiful shows of her own out of it, you know, her own kind of commentary on what that past experience was like.
Yeah,
that,
yeah.
That was very valuable, too.
So, Teresa, last question here. I mean, you... this show, Awkwafina is Nora from Queens, is about to launch. It's almost 30 years after Margaret Cho, you know, tried her own show. I mean, I guess, how are you feeling now on the eve of this show launching on Comedy Central?
Oh, we're so grateful. We're so excited. And we're just, you know, Margaret Cho basically walked so that Nora could run. Like, without her and without people like her, we wouldn't be here today. I mean, she was such an integral part of Awkwafina's life and of my life, of thinking, hey, here's a really funny woman in comedy and she's Asian. Oh my God. She really did influence both of us, I think, in terms of, wow, we can be that person too. And so it is exciting because obviously there are not that many shows that feature our community, and there are not that many shows that allow Asian Americans to create this content. And so we're definitely excited. We hope people like it, but we're also really proud, not only obviously representation in front of the camera, but also, like BD mentioned, representation behind the camera of having all female or Asian directors, having 2/3 of our department heads on the crew were women. We're really proud of the show.
BD Wong is one of the stars of Awkwafina is Nora from Queens, and Teresa Hsiao is one of the show's executive producers. BD, Teresa, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
That's our show for today. Remember, you can always call us about anything at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. If you missed any of today's show, check out The Takeaway in your podcast feeds. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Arun Vandegopal, in for Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.